We return to our story in 1 Samuel chapter 25 today, beginning at verse number 39, which is kind of the follow-up to the death of Nabal. And you remember, Nabal was a rich man of Maon and Carmel, whose shepherds David and his men had protected over the months previous. But when David sent messengers to the festival of wool gathering to get a little takeout food from this happy time, Nabal refused and treated David with great disrespect. And this made David so mad. And I told you, I think that he was transferring a lot of the frustration and anger that he's been wrestling with about Saul and Saul's men and former comrades of his. I think he's transferring a lot of that over against Nabal. And he was planning on killing him and anyone associated with him for this insult. But Nabal's wife, Abigail, who was a much better person, gathered all the appropriate festival foods, and she rode on her donkey and took donkeys and went down the direction that she knew David would be in and met him and stopped him from carrying out his plan of anger. And David acknowledged that she was a godsend because her words convinced him that it would have been wrong for him to kill Nabal, that God himself is the one that needs to deal with such circumstances, that needs to be left into God's judgment. And so David had turned around and gone back. Abigail, the next morning, informed her no doubt hungover husband just how close his foolishness came to getting them all killed. And because of that, he had some sort of health event, perhaps a stroke, perhaps a heart attack, but something happens where he dies about 10 days later. And the writer of this part of 1 Samuel, a prophet no doubt, says that it was because God struck him. So this was God's judgment, not just simply for the insult that he did toward David, but all of his life, because he's been an unrighteous man. Verse 39. When David heard that Nabal was dead, he said, "Blessed be he who is, who has avenged the insult I received at the hand of Nabal, and has kept back his servant from wrongdoing. He who is has returned the evil of Nabal on his own head." So David, when he finds out, says, God has carried out justice. And again, not just simply for what Nabal did to him, but everything that Nabal's been doing. He's a bad guy. His own employees talk about how horrible he is. And his own wife acknowledges that he is the Nabal, the fool, the ungodly man. And now judgment has fallen on him, and he's out of the picture. Which now brings a problem for us. Remember that while David is a man after God's own heart, he is a man that does have some poor choices in his life. All of us do this. We make choices based on circumstances that maybe we should have thought better about, pondered over longer before we engaged in it. And so David is going to make some choices here that we need to be honest in our evaluation, that they were not the good choice. So let's read the rest of verse 39. It says, "Then David sent and spoke to Abigail to take her as his wife." So she is now a widow, but she is a woman that he's impressed with and feels that she would be a perfect ally for him to have. And this is the way that leaders and kings thought in the Middle East back at this time, is that you made alliances, business and regional and country to country alliances through marriages. Now, God had said that this was not the way it was supposed to be done. God had warned through Moses almost 500 years earlier, or actually a little over 400 years earlier, that kings should not multiply to themselves wives or horses. So the wives represented these alliances, and the horses represented high-tech military stuff. So David is going to now make a choice to marry Abigail, which under other circumstances would have been a perfectly good idea because she's a good woman. But he is already married or has been married to the princess, the daughter of Saul, Michal. Now we'll discover in a moment that that marriage has been ended without David's cooperation. It was forced into divorce by Saul himself. But David doesn't just simply marry Abigail. He also marries somebody else that he's met in this region down here in the south while he's been on the run. We'll get to her name in a moment. Verse 40. When the servants of David came to Abigail at Carmel, they said to her, David has sent us to you to take you to him as his wife. And she rose and bowed with her face to the ground and said, Behold, your handmaid is a servant to wash the feet of the servants of my Lord. And Abigail hurried and rose and mounted a donkey, and her five young women attended her. She followed the messengers of David and became his wife. So she is in agreement with this. She apparently likes the idea of being married to the future king of Israel. And so she now becomes part of David's entourage. But it's not just her. Look at verse 43. David also took Ahinoam of Jezreel, and both of them became his wives. Now, this is not the Jezreel up in the north. This is Jezreel down here in southern Judah. It's listed in one of the lists of Joshua, I think, in close proximity to Maon and Carmel. And so David has met this other woman, Ahinoam, in his recent activities down here, and has decided that she would also be a good ally, a good partner in his life. So he is now married to two women and divorced from a third, because verse 44 tells us, Saul had given Michal, his daughter, David's wife, to Palti, the son of Laish, who was of Galim. So Saul, as soon as David was gone and on the run, decides that he wants his daughter divorced from her and makes it official and then makes it permanent by marrying her off to somebody else. And this is going to be a problem later in the story with David, because David doesn't think of himself as having been divorced from this wife of his youth. Remember, he and Michal got married probably back when he was a teenager still, probably 18, 19. And so that's been about 10 years ago. So they've been married a good long time. And David won't let that marriage go, even though she's married to another man already. We'll save that for later. Verse 1 of chapter 26 now. Then the Ziphites came to Saul at Gibeah, saying, Is not David himself hiding on the hill of Hakilah, which is on the east of Yeshimon? Now, this sounds familiar because this happened once before. where David was down in this same region, and the Ziphites ratted him out. So Saul arose and went down to the wilderness of Ziph with 3,000 chosen men of Israel to seek David in the wilderness of Ziph. And Saul encamped on the hill of Hakilah, which is beside the road on the east of Jeshimon. But David remained in the wilderness. And when he saw that Saul came after him into the wilderness, David sent out spies and learned that Saul had come. And then David rose and came to the place where Saul had encamped. And David saw the place where Saul lay with Abner, the son of Ner, the commander of his army. Saul was lying within the encampment while the army was encamped around him. So David is a lot more intentional this time around. When Saul comes down here with his expeditionary force of 3,000 soldiers looking for him, David keeps a close watch on his movements. And once he puts up this encampment and everybody goes to bed, David sneaks into the encampment. Now that means he has to get past the sentries that are keeping an eye on the perimeter of the camp. And the way that they would have done it, that was pretty much continued to be done throughout the centuries of warfare, is that the king or the commander would always be at the center of the encampment so that there would be lots of perimeter around him so that nobody could just sneak in and assassinate him. So David, though, manages to get past all of those perimeter guards with some of his own guys. So what we read next, you've got to imagine it happening with a lot of signals and mouthed wording in the middle of the night with just the light of maybe a campfire that's going on up near where Saul is sleeping and maybe a little bit of careful whispering. Okay? So you've got to picture all that because I can't do it justice in my voicing of this story. It says, "Then David said to Ahimelech the Hittite and to Joab's brother Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, who will go down with me into the camp to Saul?" And Abishai said, "I'll go down with you." Now, Abishai is his nephew, but because he's the son of David's older sister, Abishai and David are closer in age than you would normally see for an uncle and a nephew. So Abishai volunteers, "I will go with you." So David and Abishai went to the army by night. And there lay Saul sleeping within the encampment with his spear stuck into the ground at his head, and Abner and the army lay around him. And then said Abishai to David, and this is where you have to imagine Abishai whispering or maybe signaling or mouthing some words, "God has given your enemy into your hand this day. Now, please, let me pin him to the ground with one stroke of the spear. I'll not strike him twice." So Abishai volunteers, "I will kill him now. God has put him into our hands to get rid of him. I'll use his own spear against him. I'll stab him through and leave him pinned there. And he'll be dead from the first stroke. I won't have to hit a second time." And so the ultimate insult, to be killed with your own weapon. That's what he wants to offer this king, Saul, that has become the tyrant of Israel. Verse number 9. But David said to Abishai, and again, you got to picture him whispering back, "Do not destroy him, for who can put his hand against he who is his anointed and be guiltless?" So he answers the same thing this time that he did the last time he had an opportunity to kill King Saul. Remember, that was in the cave. He says, "God's the one that had him anointed. God needs to be the one that takes him out. And heaven help anybody that does it without God's direct, specific approval. So no, you may not kill him, and I'm not going to kill him. Verse number 10, David said, "As he who is lives, he who is will strike him, or his day will come to die, or he will go down into battle and perish." So maybe just of old age. Saul is likely in his 60s now, because he's been on the throne since he was right around 40. That's my guess, because he had a son old enough to be in battle when he first became king. So that would mean he had about a 20-year-old son, so 20 years older than that would make Saul about 40, and now 20 years after that makes him very close to 60. So maybe he'll die of old age, maybe he'll get killed in battle, maybe God will strike him down in some other way. Verse 11, "He who is forbid that I should put out my hand against he who is his anointed, but take now the spear that is at his head and the jar of water and let us go." So he says, okay, Abishai, here's the deal. We're not going to kill him, but I do want proof we've been this close. Take his personal weapon, his spear, and take his canteen. And so David took the spear and the jar of water from Saul's head, and they went away. No man saw it or knew it, nor did any awake, for they were all asleep because a deep sleep from he who is had fallen upon them. Now, I was talking earlier about the perimeter guards around the edges. They could have snuck by them. But usually in an encampment, there's going to be people awake, especially up near the commander's area. Here the prophet that's writing this down says that God made them all fall into a deep sleep, aiding David into coming to the very center of the camp and getting those items. Verse number 13. "Then David went over to the other side, and he stood far off on the top of a hill with a great space between them." So he puts some distance between him and the encampment. And he's also got some height on it. So he's up on a higher area, which means that he can get out of there a lot faster. It's still apparently night. Verse 14, "David called to the army, and specifically to Abner, the son of Ner." Abner is King Saul's cousin, and he is functioning as the commander of the forces. So he says, "Will you not answer, Abner?" And Abner answered, "Who are you who calls to the king?" And David said to Abner, "Are you not a man? Who is like you in Israel?" See, he and Abner know each other. He has worked with and for Abner for years. "Why then have you not kept watch over your lord the king? For one of the people came in to destroy the king, your lord. This thing that you've done is not good. As he who is lives, you deserve to die, because you did not keep watch over your lord, he who is his anointed. And now, see where the king's spear is and the jar of water which was at his head." So David is raking the commander of the army over the coals for not doing his job of keeping Saul safe. Now, David may have actually felt that Abner was part of the problem, part of the ongoing lie about who David is and what he's trying to do to King Saul. But he points out, "You're responsible for keeping the king safe in the encampment. You didn't, because someone was right down there next to the king's head. Where's his personal weapon? Where's his canteen? Tell me that." Verse 17, "Saul recognized David's voice and said, 'Is this your voice, my son David?' And David said, 'It is my voice, my lord, O king.' And he said, Why does my lord pursue after his servant? For what have I done? What evil is on my hands? Now, therefore, let my lord the king hear the words of his servant. If it is he who has stirred you up against me, may he accept an offering. But if it is men, may they be cursed before he who is. For they've driven me out this day that I should not have no share in the heritage of he who is, saying, go serve other gods. So David now is kind of venting that feeling that we've seen in the Psalms recently, that people on Saul's staff are keeping this pot stirred up, lying about David, keeping Saul angry at David and wanting to kill him. And because of that, David can't come home. He can't go to the tabernacle and worship. He is an outcast of his own country, his own family's holdings, that is Bethlehem, and of his own worship abilities. And it's all because of this. Verse 20, now therefore let not my blood fall to the earth away from the presence of he who is. For the king of Israel has come out to seek a single flea like one who hunts a partridge on the mountains. So don't make me die away from my land and away from the tabernacle. Let me be able to come home. Quit chasing me. Why are you doing it anyway? What am I? I'm like a flea. Why would you try to kill a flea with 3,000 soldiers? I'm like a partridge. Why are you hunting one partridge? One partridge. Verse number 21. Then Saul said, I have sinned. Return, my son David, for I will no more do you harm, because my life was precious in your eyes this day. Behold, I have acted foolishly and have made a great mistake. So it sounds as if he's sincere at this point, that he realizes that David had a second chance to cut his throat and he didn't take it. Why would a man that was seeking his life try to avoid it like that? And then let him know. So it doesn't make any sense. So he says, I'm sorry. You can come home. I won't try to track you down. I won't try to kill you anymore. David answered and said, here is the spear, O king. Let one of the young men come over and take it. He who is rewards every man for his righteousness and his faithfulness. For he who is gave you into my hand today, and I would not put out my hand against he who is his anointed. Behold, as your life is precious this day in my sight, so may my life be precious in the sight of he who is, and may he deliver me out of all tribulation. Saul said to David, blessed be you, my son David. You will do many things and will succeed in them. And so David went his way, and Saul returned to his place. So David and Saul have this one last interaction, proving that David is not out to kill Saul and take away the throne ahead of time, that he has nothing but respect and honor toward him, no malice. And so David is able to depart away from the encampment without having to worry too much about being tracked down at this exact moment. Saul seems to want to go back to Gibeah and leave David alone. But David, upon reflection, can't imagine that Saul is going to let it go. I mean, he's thought that before. And pretty soon, Saul is believing the lies and trying to kill him again. So chapter 27 begins with this information. Then David said in his heart, now I shall perish one day by the hand of Saul. There is nothing better for me than I should escape to the land of the Philistines. And then Saul will despair of seeking me anymore within the borders of Israel, and I shall escape from his hand. So David's evaluation is, as long as I am inside the boundaries that Saul has control of, so if I stay inside the boundaries of Israel, sooner or later, Saul is going to try to kill me again. And it's possible one of these days he's going to catch up with me. I need to go into Philistine territory. Not borderland, but into the Philistine territory itself. And make some sort of arrangements for asylum there. Because Saul is not going to invade Philistia to get me. So verse 2, David arose and went over, he and the 600 men who were with him, to Achish, the son of Maok, king of Gath. And David lived with Achish in Gath, he and his men, every man with his household, and David with his two wives, Ahinoam of Jezreel, and Abigail of Carmel, Nabal's widow. And when it was told Saul that David had fled to Gath, he no longer sought him. Now you remember the last time that David passed through Gath, he was grabbed as the warrior of Israel and the killer of Goliath. And he feigns being insane in front of this same Achish to escape from their custody. Because as Achish said at that time, don't I have enough crazy people in my own country? You've got to bring me an imported one. Well, David now is not going to fake insanity. He is going to make an actual appeal to Gath, to the king of Gath. Let me have asylum here.